This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. What comes to mind when I mention the actor Chris Sarandon? Well, let's see. His role as the evil Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride, perhaps one of the most beloved movies of all time, reaching cult status by people of all ages throughout the years. I didn't think his role was completely evil. In fact, I thought it had a touch of humanity in his misguidedness, but that's Chris Sarandon. And oh yes, then there's Fright Night, one of the most entertaining films of all time, achieving yet again cult status. Chris Sarandon was beguiling as the vampire Jerry Dandridge, literally the vampire next door. And his beautiful voice being shared in The Nightmare Before Christmas, conceived by the brilliant wunderkind at the time, Tim Burton, a film so clever that it is still considered after 30 years to be one of the most innovative animated films of all time. Another cult status wonder. And I haven't even mentioned his Academy Award-nominated turn in Dog Day Afternoon or his vast theatrical achievements on stage with everyone from Sigourney Weaver to Joel Grey. If you had to invest money in any of his projects, I would say it's a good investment. Everything he does turns to gold and cult status. Just the truth. And that might just include the beautiful concept of his podcast, Cooking by Heart, a show which brings his love of food, love of family, and memory and devotion to celebrity storytellers who, through sharing recipes, reveal who they really are. Well, Chris Sarandon, I love it that you're back. The third time is a charm. It is great to have you on Center Stage, and thank you for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure, Pamela. Always, always.
So we're coming up to season three on this fabulous Cooking by Heart.
My Absolutely. God. Yeah. It just has sort of whizzed by. I don't know how this happened, but suddenly I'm coming up on 50 shows. And we have had a wonderful time doing, literally, I can't think of one episode that I haven't personally enjoyed tremendously. And I obviously always hope that the folks who tune into the podcast do as well.
You can see that in your work. And I was there in Fairfield when you were live on stage with the food specialist and enthusiast and author and restaurateur Alice Waters. And you were amazing. It was like we were sitting in your living room and you're talking to one of the greatest ladies of all time in food. You're a warm host, I've got to say.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed Alice very much. I admire so much her work over the years, you know, obviously with this extraordinary restaurant that she created, Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, but also in her becoming the kind of the mother of the farm-to-table movement in this country by virtue of her spending time in France and experiencing the way the French use food in the restaurant business, not just as something that you sit down and eat, but also an experience that comes from where the food comes from.
Yeah, exactly.
And her work in seasonal cooking, specifically, that is, the Chez Panisse almost exclusively works with food that is in season, not only in season, but also locality, that is, the food being local. And also this extraordinary program that she created, in which she has managed to install gardens in over 6,500 schools worldwide, which is just an accomplishment beyond belief, really.
And really, Chris, this factors into our world in these times.
Yeah.
We need to be thinking about food, about water, about feeding everyone.
Yes. Yeah. And sustainability.
Exactly. And you talk about the locality of the foods that she honors. And when I see you on Instagram in your own garden, caressing your beautiful vegetables, and you seem to delight in just the visceral and organic quality of growing things.
It's been such an important part of my life. I started gardening when I was in my, I guess, late 20s. We were at the time living in Westchester County near the actress Colleen Dewhurst. I had worked with Colleen in a play, and we would visit her often, and we ultimately bought a small house near her. And she had a couple of gentlemen working for her who lived near her, and one of them was an inveterate gardener, had been gardening all of his life. And I just thought I'm attracted to this in so many different ways. The freshness of the food, the actual act of seeing something grow from a seed to something that you're sitting at the table eating. And I basically just looked over his shoulder for a couple of summers, and it's been part of my life ever since.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
And here you're coming completely full circle again. I think we've spoken about this before because you literally grew up with parents who ran a restaurant
Yes.
in West Virginia. I mean,
Yeah,
this is part of
my
your
dad,
life.
a Greek immigrant who came here in the 1920s, with nothing, literally, and worked his way up to a point where he could buy a little restaurant of his own. Then he brought everybody over from the family, his brothers, his two of his sisters, and they worked together in the restaurant. And I worked there from the time I was 9 years old, until I went away to college. And it's interesting to me because part of the impetus for cooking by heart has to do with not just the fact that I worked in the restaurant from when I was a kid, and trying to help my guests associate that time in their lives and their experiences with food, but also the fact that it is so much a part of my DNA. Both my grandfathers. One of them had a little coffee shop, the other had a small restaurant, and later a sidewalk stand or food purveying stand. I have a son who's a trained chef. Both of my daughters are great cooks. My wife is an amazing cook, Joanna Gleason, an amazing cook, and we share a lot of time in the kitchen. And we essentially cook almost every night of the week.
That's
We don't eat
extraordinary.
out a lot, we don't order in a lot. And it has become so much a part of the fabric of my life that I don't know where I'd be without it, quite frankly.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So when did you decide to move to Connecticut? I believe you bought a farm and where you do raise all of your you have your
Well, we
pets.
didn't buy a farm per se, but we certainly have dedicated a good part of the property to my garden in the backyard. And also raising trees and apples and fruit
Okay.
as well. But it came about because at the time Joanna and I were living in Los Angeles. We had both been in New York. We had been in a play together in New York, a musical that was one of the biggest flops in Broadway history. We may talk about this at some point. You mentioned it earlier in our conversation before we went on the air. When we moved to California, and then when we decided to move back, Joanna had gotten a Broadway show. I had gotten a Broadway show. And so we had been renting our house in Los Angeles and thought, this is crazy. We sold our house, and we needed to reinvest the money in the sale of the house. And it made no sense to buy an apartment in New York City because the prices were ridiculous. And for what we could buy a one-bedroom apartment in New York, we spent on a fixer-up house in Connecticut. And we looked at, oh gosh, we probably looked at 40 or 50 houses. And for some reason, this house that we're in now, it was in disrepair, to put it mildly. But there was something about it that spoke to us, about its future, about what it could be, and also what the property could be. And so that's what we did. We just, said, what the hell, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And we bought this house. And over the years, we have, get a job, do a room, get a job, plant a few trees. And the accumulated working capital has been converted into living capital, which is what we enjoy so much.
I think we all can relate to that. Get a job in the performing arts, get a
Yeah.
job, and then we can put on that new deck if we want to on the house.
Yeah, exactly.
And with you're literally growing things. Chris, I feel that this is so important at this junction in our lives. Coming out of COVID, you and I spoke several times during COVID. We've come out of it, we've come out into uncertain times,
Yes.
and chaos. And I recently did a show on recollection and remembrance and why Many of us go back to watching old movies we love, old TV series we can relate to. And really, it's because it gives us a feeling of safety and connection. I can't help but feel that you have had that impetus in building Cooking by Heart. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The universal impulse to gather with people and over food share memories and family experiences and friendships and love. So much of it takes place in every culture over food. It certainly was the case in my growing up in my father's restaurant and at home with my family, with my mother and my dad and all the relatives who lived nearby and friends who would come from sometimes, great distances just to sit down at a meal.
What a beautiful gathering. I love it. And you're right, the sharing of stories, the deep connection. And with you, I believe you have nine grandchildren. And everyone is always coming to the table, literally.
We get together as often as we can. We live close enough so that we can see each other relatively frequently, but far enough so that we don't see each other all the time. So the distance, which is not great, but it's still there, it provides even more of a pull for us to want to get together. And when we do, we all cook. My kids cook. We encourage the grandchildren to help us always when we're having food with the little ones. One or two of them will always, be up on a stool around the kitchen counter, wanting to crack an egg or use the hand, the whisk, breaking up the eggs in the recipe, or if it's something else, decorating something or creating something that is culinary, and it provides a wonderful kind of glue. In the family.
To the experience. I love it. Well, let's talk about the current season of Cooking by Heart. You've started with Rosanna Arquette. Wow. So, what
Rosanna
did
was my
she
first
bring
guest.
to the table?
Well, a fascinating, fascinating life when she started out. First of all, both of her parents were actors, and her siblings were all have all become actors over the
Absolutely.
years. They're all fairly well known, or very well known. And Rosanna describes, in fact, her early experiences of food were first class takeout. That there was always a lot of first class fast food in her house. There wasn't a lot of cooking because both of her parents worked, and she was. Her relationship with food was very sort of tangential until she got a little bit older. Then her parents moved to a commune or created a commune. So there was communal food, which was not great in the culinary end of things, but was wonderful in the sense that there was community, a lot of people together sitting and eating food. But then when she left, she became a self-taught cook. And concurrently was discovered at a very young age in Hollywood when she was like 17 years old. So she tells great stories about, first of all, growing up in that family and also her culinary awakenings, how she started discovering how to put things together for herself, some of the things she does even today when she and her siblings get together and cook, also stories about some of the experiences she's had while shooting films, and some of the unfortunate ones, including her well-documented brush with the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein, and that situation. So she's a very candid and a very interesting conversationalist and a fabulous woman who's lived a great life.
How fascinating. I love it. What a start to even include the Harvey Weinstein kind of perspective into this. This is incredible. Incredible. So Chris Randon, tell me how you have changed over the past three seasons. I mean, and this one that has just started, in your regard to many of the celebrities you've known in your work, many who you've worked with, And their stories through food and recollection. How has that affected you now then in comparatively to when you first started cooking by heart?
Well, I think originally when I started doing it, it was as you mentioned, during the pandemic, and every actor I knew was languishing, right? And my brother-in-law, who was a great podcast fan and who was also a television writer producer, has been working for a number of years on lots of great, mostly network, but sometimes cable television. And he suggested I do a podcast because we were basically sitting around. And I said, "Well, what am I going to do a podcast about?" And he said, "Come on. You grew up in a restaurant. Your father is, you're Greek. You cook for us all the time. Do it about food." And I came up with the idea of my entry into the vast number of food shows was more unique to me, and that is, I grew up around it. So
Right.
what was it like for you, my guest, right? So from the beginning, I started talking to people about it, and I continued from the very beginning to be surprised by people's experiences because they were, on the one hand, very different from mine, but on the other hand, so universal. That is, I'll contrast a couple of the early shows, for instance. I did an early show, one of my first shows, with a wonderful author and raconteur and now podcaster, an amazing woman named Adriana Trajani, who's written a number of novels. And Adri's life was similar to mine in that we both grew up in Appalachia. She started in an earlier in her younger years in another location, and then she moved from Pennsylvania to Virginia and a coal mining community. Where, and my that was my upbringing as well. I grew up in a coal mining community, and but in a big Italian family, where everything was food, 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 colorful, wonderful cooks. The women, of course, were the great cooks. The men sometimes cooked and picking their food fresh, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of my, maybe my second guest was Michael Patrick King. Michael, who was one of the creators of Sex and the City and
Yes.
is the current showrunner on its on the sequel that's on HBO. And Michael's experience was horrible in the culinary part of his life because his mother was a terrible cook. She was very unhappy. There was lots of friction in the family. And yet the stories were just as rich, but in a different way. I mean, Michael described, for instance, that the only time there was flavor in the food in his house was when his mother cried in the mashed potatoes. So while the culinary richness was of a different sort, it was still rich. And that's what surprised me. I wasn't prepared quite for that. I was, and have been, by the way, all the way through the first season, the second season, where I get a lot of stories from people who, particularly during certain epochs of our history or certain periods of our history, where women were subjugated to the home, where they were expected to be homemakers, take care of the children, there were stories of a lot of unhappy mothers who were bright and motivated and wanted to be out in the world, but were constrained by whatever was going on in the culture. Okay. Sometimes they turned into wonderful cooks, and sometimes they turned into, to use a taste phrase, bitter, bitter cooks. But their stories were still very rich for for their variety and for their efforts to create for their families a rich life, be it through food or through some other way. And so I don't think I was quite prepared for the variety of stories, and also the fact that while a lot of the stories lacked details of great sort of culinary triumph, there were triumphs in other areas of people's lives, particularly the women. And that was just as important because the show is not just about the food, as you say, it's about the people and the stories.
That's right. It is. And about what comes forth. It's almost like therapy, Chris.
Oh,
And
absolutely.
I would think there would be times where you would be doing a show and you close your computer and just sit back and sigh and think, Wow. I mean,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I am
That's,
overwhelmed. I am
oh, so
overcome
many times.
with the passion.
So many times. Yeah.
Look what you have opened up.
In me and hopefully for my audience.
Oh, there's no question about it. There's
Yeah.
no question about it. You seem so ease at being in the podcaster's chair. Did you feel in the beginning that this needed to be worked at? I mean, you're an actor. You've accomplished so many great things in your life. You have so much finesse. Was it difficult in the beginning and even in now, interviewing people and trying to find that part of themselves where you feel you can develop trust, let's say?
Well, what I've tried to do, and with I think some success, is to balance listening, very particularly listening, with to my guests, with relating what we have in common, because in a way I'm the conduit to the audience.
That's right.
And the audience needs to know that somebody else has had that same experience that my guest has had. Sometimes I have had that experience. And I will say, oh God, yeah, it was like that for me too. Or I remember this particular food that my mom prepared that was similar to the one that you're talking about, that your mother or your father prepared, or that we had in my dad's restaurant. Because I think that gives the audience an entree into how they can relate in the same way. I'm hoping that they're sitting there going, oh yeah, that happened to me too when I was around. We had those same conversations when we were sitting around the table. Or I knew a family who, that was like that because we never talked at the table. Sometimes it was
Exactly.
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it, to me, it's as much about, it's much more about the guest and about listening, but also about trying to provide enough of myself that an audience can identify.
Yeah, exactly. There's the trust.
Yeah.
And that would be my next question. How far do you feel you can go, with a guest? I mean, I suppose you're trying to be empathetic along the way and really feel, what the perspective is from that person. And of course, the temperature in the room,
Absolutely. It depends on the, you have to be very much, as an actor does, you have to be very much in the moment. You can't be thinking about what you're going to be asking next, which is another thing that I've learned is don't prepare so much. That you have to sort of follow where things lead you. And it's important to have research and to know about the person that you're talking to. On the one hand, but on the other hand, if the person leads you somewhere, then you have to be willing to follow, and follow in an empathic way, so that they're comfortable enough to go further. And some of the things that people have told me have been quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and precious
Yeah.
to be handled deftly.
Yeah.
Who do you have on the outside helping you along the way? Do you have mentors, advisors? Is the wonderful Joanna Gleason back there saying,
Absolutely.
Chris, I think you should have gone this direction?
Yes, Joanna has been from day one the voice that I want to hear, and she's helped me guide it very much so, particularly with the live shows, because in the beginning, the live shows were I was awkward, it was tough, and I sort of found my way through it. I was very nervous. I hadn't appeared on stage in a number of years. So that when I did, I think my first live show was with Adriana Trigiani, but Adriana was, she's so outgoing that it was very easy.
The perfect guest. Yeah.
But then I had a couple of guests who were a little more reticent, and also the whole idea of introducing myself to the audience, to a live audience, very different from sitting in front of a mic. I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience as well.
Yes. Yes.
So I had to find my way with that too, and it's gotten easier as time has gone along. And yet, at the same time, I'm still very critical of myself and what did I do and what I like. There's one show that I did this year where I finished and I went, why didn't I get into that? She was talking about this particular thing and I wanted to follow it up. And for some reason, my brain was somewhere else. I'd been on a red eye the night before, so I had something of an excuse, but it was not enough of an excuse. I should have been able to follow that line. So it's, you know, and it's always, it's like being in a play in a way. You know, there's a script, but the audience changes things. And in this case, the guest changes things.
That's right. That's right. I think one of the difficulties there too, when you're on stage, you know, when you're doing a play or any kind of performance, you're reaching out and connecting with the audience.
Yes.
And when you're interviewing a guest and you're really responsible for that energy, you know, that's a completely different dynamic.
Oh.
And you can't play off the audience. You're playing off that guest. Like you say, the most important thing, the element is listening. I have to say, when I came to see you interview Alice Waters, I felt like I was literally sitting in your living room. I felt a general ease, which I appreciated. It was just very comfortable, and you just allowed her to speak and unfold. I loved it.
Yeah, and she's really quite an extraordinary woman.
As you can see, Chris Sarandon is the kind of guy you want to invite around to your dinner table. I encourage all of you to take up an invitation to his podcast, Cooking by Heart, at chrissarandon.com. And if you haven't seen them, please check out Fright Night and The Princess Bride for just two of his memorable turns as the actor we cherish. Come back next week and join us on Center Stage to hear part two of our interview where we speak about his films. And you can go to centerstagewithpamelacoon.com for more shows like this and to hear my other interviews with Chris Sarandon. In the meantime, stay safe out there, everyone. This is Pamela Coon, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.